Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, lovely Campbell Hall here on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have a terrific show for you. Our guest is someone who has been a frequent guest in Media Matters, in fact, without question, our most frequent guest. But for the first time in Media Matters history, we're going to have him as our guest, I believe, when we aren't trying to get people to make a pledge to support this show and to support the station. He is none other than John Nichols, the nation's Washington correspondent and an editor at the Capital Times newspaper up in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the co-author of several books with yours truly, Bob McChesney, most recently Tragedy and Farce, as well as several solo authored books, including his brand new book that we're going to be talking about today, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. John Nichols is also the covers domestic politics and international politics as a journalist for The Nation, as I said, and is equipped to talk about the upcoming elections for those of you interested in discussing those issues, too. So, John Nichols, welcome to the air.
It's great to be on with you. That's the introduction I guess I'd ask for.
Well, very
I'm glad
good.
I wrote it.
And well, I'm glad you wrote this book, The Genius of Impeachment, which I had the privilege of reading yesterday and today when I pulled into town last night. And, you know, I'm a fan of your work, obviously. But I think this is a book that a lot of people will enjoy reading because it gives a real context for appreciating the role impeachment plays in a democratic society and why it is in the U.S. Constitution. And I don't think always people are we're aware of what exactly, you know, why impeachment exists and what the point of it is. And, you know, before we get into this, John, let's just talk a little bit about a couple of the people at the beginning of the book who you honor. You sort of pay tribute to Henry Gonzalez and Barbara Jordan.
Yeah.
And before we go into some of the history and context of impeachment, talk about the Bush administration today and its impeachability.
Okay.
Talk a little bit about why you pick Henry Gonzalez as someone to hold up at the beginning of the book and really pay homage to.
Well, I'll give you a good example of the answer to that question. In an email I just got this morning from a friend of mine who's been a leader nationally in the efforts to raise the issue of impeachment, David Swanson, who's just an incredibly great activist with After Downing Street and the Censure Bush campaign and things of that nature. And he had just read the book, and he sent me this long email with all the things he didn't know about impeachment. And the point is, this is a guy who's like deep into the process and was stunned to learn lots of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the bottom line reason I wrote the book, is because I felt that the history of impeachment, the understanding of it, what it's all about, has been virtually lost to America. It's not taught in our schools. It's not at all understood in our media. Our media treats impeachment like it's hemlock or some sort of horrible, dangerous thing.
Yeah, something like conspiracy busts come up with.
Right. It's nutty. It's dangerous. It's a quote-unquote constitutional crisis, to which I always say that's like calling aspirin a headache crisis. I mean, it's the cure for a constitutional crisis. So to give people an understanding of that, I went back to someone who, in my view, understood impeachment better than anyone else, and that was Henry B. Gonzalez. He was a son of the barrio. His parents were Mexicans who immigrated to San Antonio in the early part of the 20th century. He was born and raised in the barrio of San Antonio, went to Knight Law School, and I'll tell you something, that Knight Law School taught him the Constitution very, very well. Because he became an activist in the 30s and 40s for Mexican-American civil rights, which in that time in Texas was very similar to being an advocate for African-American civil rights in Mississippi or Alabama. And he got himself elected to the city council and then to the state senate. Amazingly enough, he ran for governor of Texas in 1958 as a Latino and did very well, actually was a very viable candidate. Didn't make it, but turned around and got himself elected to Congress. He served in Congress for the better part of 30 years, and this is why I honor Henry B. Gonzalez. Every time a president took this country to war without the approval of Congress, without an actual act of war decision by the Congress, a declaration of war, he filed articles of impeachment because he said correctly that the Constitution clearly gives that power to Congress. When a president seizes it and sends young men and women to die in, you know, distant battlefields, That is a violation of the Constitution. It cannot be accepted. So Henry B. Gonzalez filed articles of impeachment or supported articles of impeachment against Nixon for the illegal bombing of Cambodia, against Reagan for the attack on Grenada, against Bush, the dad, for twice for attacks on Kuwait and Iraq. And he also filed articles of impeachment against Reagan for Iran-Contra. The interesting thing is, we know about all these historical moments in history, you know, Cambodia bombing, Grenada, Iran-Contra, Iraq. But what we don't know is that in most of those cases, Henry B. Gonzalez filed those articles of impeachment alone. Even though he was a senior member of Congress, one of the most powerful committee chairmen in the House, even his fellow Democrats wouldn't join him. What I argue in the opening of the book is, had they joined him, had more members of Congress recognized the importance of holding the executive to account along the way through Grenada, through Iran-Contra, through the first wars in the Persian Gulf, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today. The crisis in America, the disaster in the American experiment, comes when members of Congress, no matter what their party, no matter what their ideology, fail to hold presidents to account, because each failure strengthens the hand of the executive. And everything that's wrong today with our president, with our vice president, with where the executive branch is, spying illegally, launching wars without proper authorization, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, can be traced back to failures in the past to hold presidents to account. If we don't hold George Bush to account now, I think Henry B. Gonzalez would tell us, then the next president will do worse things, and the president after that even worse. Impeachment is not about the man. It is about the office. It is about the branch of government. Only through impeachment do we prevent presidents from getting out of control. And so that's why I honor Henry B. Gonzalez. He understood it at a time when I wish a lot of other people had, because I don't think if he hadn't had to stand alone, my suspicion is that we wouldn't be in the mess we're in today.
One other Texan in the House of Representatives, also a pioneering figure, is Barbara Jordan, and you invoke her early on in the book and favorably. What was Barbara Jordan's contribution to our understanding of impeachment?
Well, the incredible thing is that the most powerful memory most people have of impeachment is not the Clinton mess of the late 1990s, which was really an abuse of the procedure. It was the early 1970s efforts to hold Richard Nixon to account for various acts that were illegal, immoral, unconstitutional. And the interesting thing is that when the process of holding Nixon to account began, many people don't remember that the idea of impeaching Nixon was quite foreign to the Congress. It wasn't. The Democrats were not leading the charge. Tip O'Neill and others were telling younger members to hold back. Don't make too much noise about this issue because it's very controversial. It might scare the voters, things like that. But on the first day of the Watergate hearings by the House Judiciary Committee, Barbara Jordan, the first African-American woman elected to Congress from the South, one of the first African-Americans elected to Congress from the South. Remember, this was only 10 years after the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, got up and gave this amazing speech. And she essentially said, you know, for most of my own lifetime, the Constitution didn't apply to me. I didn't have these privileges. I wasn't protected. I've only been brought into the political process in recent years. But maybe because of that, I have an understanding of its value and its importance that some might not. And I will tell you, older, whiter, wealthier members of this committee, that if I, Barbara Jordan, as an African-American woman, cannot hold Richard Nixon to account for the high crimes and misdemeanors that it appears he's committed, then the Constitution is irrelevant. It's just a shred of paper. And those remarks, given in her remarkable deep voice and with the passion that she brought to her comments, sort of shocked the whole committee. Everybody stopped in their tracks. And I'm not sure that a white liberal from a college town or somebody could have done it so effectively. Here was this African-American woman who was in many ways treated like she was being given a gift. Oh, here's a privilege. We allow you to sit in Congress. Saying, no. I'm a full citizen. I'm a full member of Congress. And my full responsibility is to apply the Constitution to the executive branch. And it's interesting to me, one of the things I try to bring home in the book again and again is that throughout the history of impeachment, going back to the founding of the country, it's often been tied to civil rights and social justice struggles, and struggles that could not be fully realized until the executive branch was brought down to a more reasonable level of power. When we start to apply the checks and balances to the executive, to the president of the United States, the rule of law begins to be more respected at every level of government. And so it's not a surprise that the two people that I highlight at the start of the book, and really who, if you look in the history of impeachment, are two of the great players, happen to be a Mexican-American who grew up in the barrio of San Antonio and an African-American who grew up in the segregated South. I think many very privileged whites who care about the Constitution and respect it perhaps don't have the sort of visceral reaction, the sense of a need to hold those who abuse the law to account. And so I highlight them, but throughout the book, come back again and again to these real heroes, Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, blacks and whites and Latinos and others, Christians and Jews, people of all backgrounds who at critical times in the history of this country have recognized that a president has done wrong, and that president must be held to account. And I think everybody who does that, no matter what time in history, ranks as a hero.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL AM 580. Our guest, the person you've just been listening to, is John Nichols, author of the brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism, published by New Press, literally just out this week. And John Nichols has a foreword in the book from Gore Vidal. Very flattering and interesting forward, as you can imagine, from Gore Vidal. And the book is available, as I said. We're taking calls here at Media Matters for those who'd like to call in with a question or comment for John Nichols. 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Now, I know for some of our regular listeners, you're probably undergoing cognitive dissonance right now. You're saying, what is John Nichols doing on the air if he's not begging us to send money into WILL AM 580? Well, John will be back in 2 weeks to join us for our pledge drive, so
Absolutely.
Don't worry. Don't worry. If you're reaching for your wallet whenever you hear John Nichols' voice, you can just put it back in there.
Now it's like a Pavlovian response.
I think it is. We're also going to have Amy Goodman joining us for
what
our pledge drive show.
Boy, what a loser show this is.
Yeah, in 2 weeks. And while we're on it, next week, John, I don't know if you're aware of this, and the listeners certainly aren't, but Andrew Boyle, our crack producer, has arranged that we're going to have FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein joining us live on the air 1 week from today, discussing all the stuff going on with net neutrality, with the media ownership rulemaking, the big mergers, everything the FCC is doing, and we'll have him for a full hour 1 week
really
from today.
Really one of the great heroes of the contemporary moment. I always remind people that as difficult as the Bush years have been, so the one kind of glorious thing has been this struggle for media reform, which you and I have been so involved in, but it could not have occurred. It could not be where it's at if we didn't have two FCC commissioners who were willing to listen to the people. As Chomsky always says, you know, the only time the left really prevails in a system like ours is when the elites divide. And I guess if you're an FCC commissioner, maybe you're a part of the elites, and we're lucky to have Adelstein on our side.
Well, John Nichols, let's get back to the genius of impeachment for a second. You know, one of the things I really liked about the book, and I suspect David Swanson and other people who even who are involved in the impeachment movement will learn from it, is you go to the origins of impeachment. And as you say, it's not something that's an aberration, but it's built right into our constitutional project. You know, what was the tradition that our framers had as they debated putting impeachment into the Constitution? And what was their intention? How did they see impeachment playing out in our system of government?
Well, the founders were very comfortable with impeachment. In fact, they thought impeachment was one of the most vital tools that they created. It's not a coincidence that the creation of impeachment as a constitutionally defined right and responsibility occurred at the same time that one of the great impeachment trials in the history of the world was taking place in Great Britain. Edmund Burke was trying a Viscount of India, a British colonial overseer, who had abused Indians, and it was a trial that was being used to hold to account the British system of colonialism. The American colonials, former colonials, were very conscious of this, and so they recognized impeachment as a tool that could be used to hold whoever ruled the country to account. Jefferson especially was terrified of the notion that America would become an electoral democracy but then would elect what he referred to as a king for 4 years, or an elected despot, somebody who could point to the fact that they had been chosen at an election and say, well, now I can do whatever I want for this period, for this term. He and Madison and many others wanted to make sure that in the midst of a term, in the midst of a four-year presidential term, a president or a vice president or a member of the cabinet could be quickly and effectively removed from office. They could be stopped in their tracks if they were violating the Constitution or if they were in some way harming the country, the two basic concepts there. And so they wrote in the Constitution a bold procedure for impeachment. Here's the one thing, just to give you a sense of how important the founders thought impeachment was. If you read the Constitution, you will find no mention of corporations. You will find no mention of business. You will also find no mention in the Constitution of when elections are supposed to be held, of two-party system, of conventions or caucuses or primaries or any of the things that we associate with the choosing of our leaders. There's no mention of that in the Constitution. But there are six mentions of impeachment, six different references to it, and many of them quite detailed. Why? Because Madison, Benjamin Franklin, Jefferson, the others, were not worried about how leaders were chosen. They assumed that if they gave people access to information, basic freedoms, they could choose their leaders. They were worried about making sure that once someone got power, that person could be removed if they used that power inappropriately. So the classic quote from George Mason, who was really one of the primary crafters of the Constitution, is that nothing in this document is more important than preserving the privilege and the power of impeachment.
You know, John Nichols, one of the things I thought was most interesting in this book when you're talking about the framers, you know, nowadays when people talk about impeachment, when it does come up, one of the issues that you mentioned is always raised is that, gee, impeachment causes a constitutional crisis. It throws the whole country into turmoil. It's very much a bad thing. We don't want impeachment no matter what. It really should only be used in the most extraordinary cases that are almost impossible to imagine. In particular, it should never be used at any time that our country might be at war or be in some sort of jeopardy in foreign affairs, because that would undermine our military position and our security. Yet when I read your book, what was most striking with the framers and Madison was how it was at time of war that impeachment became ever more important in their mind.
Absolutely. In fact, this blew my mind, too, because I've always known that Madison was very concerned about war. In fact, in the last few years, I've quoted Madison probably more than any of the other founders because he wrote so extensively about his terror, frankly, that a president would use a time of war, particularly a time of endless warfare, say, like George Bush in the current so-called war on terror, to not merely go after an enemy, but also to collapse and undermine basic liberties at home. And also, one of the things Madison was very conscious of, the notion that in a time of war, a president would seize what Madison saw as a president's greatest power, the power of taxation, the power of the treasury, and turn that toward enriching his friends and enhancing his power. And so Madison wrote about this a great deal. I'd always known that. In doing the research on impeachment, what I found was a remarkable series of letters between Madison and Jefferson. Jefferson did not attend the Constitutional Convention. Madison, his dear friend, would regularly send him drafts and notes and attached letters in which he explained things. In those letters, you will find an amazing discourse between Madison and Jefferson about why impeachment was so important. Their message, the core message of it, was in a time of war, when the country is most imperiled, we have to have this power of impeachment because a president will use his office in the most abusive ways in a time of war. So, far from believing that impeachment should only be used in good times, when everything was fine, they believed impeachment should be used in the worst of times, because that, to the view of the founders, was when the worst abuses would occur. So if I can, I absolutely guarantee you, I'd be willing to bet any amount of money, you know, roll any dice on this, whatever you want to say, that if Jefferson and Madison, the other founders, were around today, they would be screaming for impeachment. They wouldn't be just, you know, saying, oh, well, maybe you might want to try this idea. I think they would be saying, oh, my God, you must do it. If you do not, again, as George Mason suggested, the whole rest of the Constitution becomes irrelevant.
Our guest today, John Nichols, joining me, Bob McChesney, on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. We're coming to you live. So the phone lines are open here, 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We're discussing John Nichols' brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. So far, we've been talking a lot about the history and context of impeachment, but much of the book deals with the current crisis of the Bush administration, the challenges it faces, and the charges of impeachment there. We will be talking about those. Also, for many of our regular listeners or people who read The Nation magazine, you're aware that John Nichols is the nation's Washington correspondent and one of the leading writers on contemporary politics in the world and in the United States today. We do have midterm elections coming up a month from now, and John is at the ready for questions concerning the midterm elections for those who'd like to go in that direction. John, let's talk a little bit more about The Genius of Impeachment. One of the foils that comes up in your book is none other than Vice President Dick Cheney, who you have written about. But he sort of is the figure that, going back to the 70s, has articulated in both the Nixon and Reagan administration to more recently the position against impeachment being used. What is the Cheney argument?
Well, Cheney, of course, is one of the great believers in executive power. And this is a fight that goes back to the founding of the country. There was a handful of people at the founding that believed that the president should essentially be a king. And if you'll recall from your, you know, high school civics class or history class, there were some folks who went to George Washington at the founding of the country and said, you know, George Washington, you've been such a great general, you've been such a great leader, you're a solid, respected plantation owner, blah, blah, blah. Will you be our king? And Washington said to them, that's not what we fought for. We fought to get rid of this system of an all-powerful monarch who essentially, for the period of his or her reign, is able to do as they choose. That side lost with Washington's decision, his statement there. Unfortunately, that strain of thinking continues to this day. And Cheney is the purest embodiment of it, the most outspoken supporter of it. Dick Cheney actually believes and has stated that the president does not have enough power today, that the president is not free enough to do as he chooses. In Cheney's view, the Nixon impeachment and also the Iran-Contra hearings and other efforts to simply hold presidents to the law were horrific abuses, and he thought Congress was completely out of control in those moments. And interestingly, as an aide in the Nixon White House, and also as a member of Congress during the Iran-Contra affair, did everything in his power to undermine the ability of Congress to assert basic constitutional principles. As Secretary of Defense in the first Bush administration and now as Vice President in the second administration, he's gone out of his way to powerfully and aggressively advocate against any effort to hold the president to account, against any effort to slow this presidency down. And so I say, you know, half-heartedly or half-jokingly, but not entirely jokingly, that if we are to continue the great struggle that this country has always had over the power of the executive, then we might be wise to impeach Cheney first. Start with him. That will make people more comfortable impeaching George Bush.
Just desserts, I guess, in view of his position on the matter.
Yeah, I mean, let's some of us, those of us who still stand with George Washington, assert the principle that no, a president ought not be a king for 4 years.
Now, one of the interesting chapters in your book, John, that you deal with in The Genius of Impeachment deals with, you know, Dick Cheney, for example, is oftentimes called a political conservative. Yet in traditional political philosophy, conservatives find concentrated central power of the state anathema oftentimes and antithetical to what they consider a good society, which is to have a small government. You talk in your book about conservatives who take the opposite position from Dick Cheney, a large tradition in our country. Who are some of these conservatives?
Well, they are both historical figures and contemporary figures. Gouverneur Morrison and some of the others at the founding of the country believed this, that there were conservatives at the Constitutional Convention who were some of the most ardent advocates for impeachment, because some people, remember, at the founding of the country, didn't want us to have a strong executive at all. They weren't even sure we should have a federal government. And they certainly wanted to constrain and control it. The impulse toward impeachment is, I would argue, identical to several of the other impulses as regards the Constitution that hold true to this day. The impulse toward a true protection of freedom of the press and of free speech so that citizens can object without constraint. But also something that's considered sometimes a more conservative impulse toward the right to bear arms. And remember, if conservatives get talking about the right to bear arms, one of the things they say is, quite bluntly, people ought to have the ability to rise up and overthrow their government. And amazingly enough, you will hear that quite often at an NRA event or something like that. Well, the genius of impeachment is that it was a tool placed in the Constitution by often very conservative figures who wanted an alternative to having to rise up with arms against an unjust, corrupt, and abusive administration. They wanted to have the ability legally and structurally.
And peacefully.
Yeah, peacefully, to hold an executive to account. And so there are still many conservatives who do value this principle. There's one in Congress, in fact, one of the most conservative people in Congress, Ron Paul, a congressman from Texas.
What's with Texas? All these people are coming from Texas. Henry Gonzalez, Barbara Jordan.
Well, that frontier cowboy thing, you know, maybe a little bit of independent thinking.
Didn't hit all of them, though.
Not all of them. I think, well, remember, Bush is a native of New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay.
He's not a Texan. And he lives on a little ranchette, which our friend Jim Hightower will tell you is about as far from an actual Texas ranch as you can get. So, but the critical thing is that Ron Paul, if you read his statements on the abuses of presidential power, they read just like Russ Feingold's. I mean, he is terribly, terribly concerned about the United States being in an illegal and immoral war that was not declared by Congress. He is terribly, terribly concerned about the Patriot Act. He's terribly, terribly concerned about warrantless wiretapping. He's not alone. One of his compadres, so to speak, Bob Barr, the former congressman from Georgia, who was so involved in the Clinton impeachment and certainly angered a lot of Democrats when he did that, has proven to be consistent. Bob Barr wants to hold President Bush to account. He actually appeared in the early months of this year with former Vice President Al Gore at an event or participated in an event where they talked about the president's abuses of warrantless wiretapping. And the magazine The American Conservative, which has created a good stir on the right side of the fence politically, has carried a number of terrific articles, some of which I reference in the book, about the abuses of presidential power, about this terrible circumstance we're in. And I wrote the chapter on conservatives and impeachment because I thought it was absolutely essential that in the current discussion about holding President Bush to account, whether you're just talking about investigations or censure or even impeachment, that much more effort has to be made to reach out to rule of law conservatives, people who really do believe in the Constitution. And I argue in the book that one of the best ways to reach out to them is by saying, okay, you like George Bush, that's fine. But look at the powers that have been concentrated in the presidency under George Bush. He set up energy policy in secret. He set up a system of signing statements that allow him basically to decide whether he will follow and obey laws or disregard them. He has led us into several wars without clear declarations of war. He pushed through the Patriot Act. He secretly set up many different systems for spying on Americans via phone, via email, all sorts of stuff. The abuses go on and on and on, right up to and including an apparent scheme within the vice president's office to punish Joe Wilson for raising concerns about the administration's actions. So it's actually classic, going back to things that they rebelled against King George for, the punishing of your critics. And so you put that all those things together, say all those powers now rest in the hands of George Bush. But someday George Bush won't be president anymore. Do you want to have all of those powers rest in the hands of Hillary Clinton or Al Gore or some, you know, Democrat that you hate and fear? And, you know, the interesting thing is honest conservatives will step back and, you know, take a deep breath and say, no, I don't. And if you can get them to that point, if you can get them to accept that they don't want that, then you've begun a discussion about whether, forgetting who the current president is, some effort must be made to deconstruct, to take away the powers of the executive branch. Because if we don't address what's happened with this massive expansion of powers, we will find ourselves in a situation where another president will expand the powers even further and further and further until we get to a point where the legislative and judicial branches will be virtually irrelevant and we will have, as Jefferson feared, an elected despot or a king for 4 or 8 years.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Nichols, the Washington editor for The Nation magazine and also the author of the brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for John Nichols, the phone number here is 333-9455, our toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got a couple callers patiently waiting. Before we get to them, John, just one quick question. We had someone email a question in. Just asking, what exactly is the procedure for impeaching a president? You know, just nuts and bolts. What is the Constitution? How does it happen, John?
It's in the Constitution. That's the incredible thing. This is one of the few things where you don't have to go and read long history books. You can just get the original document. It tells you what to do.
Or get a copy of the original document if you can't make it to Philly.
Yeah, if you want to. You know, actually, it's over at the National Archives.
In D.C. Shows what I know. Okay, go ahead, John.
But, yeah, it's a copy. And it's very, very simple. The House of Representatives has the power to move articles of impeachment. Articles of impeachment are simply the case, you know, saying these are the reasons we think that this president should be charged, should be impeached. And they're best understood as an equivalent, though certainly not the same thing as the charges that might be brought against someone who was a criminal wrongdoer, lawbreaker.
So the House impeaches.
And then the Senate
holds the trial.
Exactly. And it ceases to be a legislative body and actually becomes a judicial body.
A jury.
Yeah. And the trial takes place very much like any other trial, with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court sitting as the judge.
And it takes a majority vote?
No, it actually takes more than a majority vote. It's roughly 2/3. And so impeachment's a very hard thing to get to.
And if you impeach the president, then the vice president comes in?
The vice president immediately takes off.
Isn't that a flaw? I mean, because that was written back in the period when vice presidents and presidents were elected separately.
Well, exactly. So it's not really a flaw. In fact, it's an intent from the original times that the assumption that the president and the vice president might not even like each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would have a real change. Now, in this day of political party tickets, remember something that the Constitution never anticipated. The idea of a president and vice president running together as a ticket,
mm-hmm.
not something the founders imagined. And so, yeah, we have to, you know, in that sense, sort of have a living constitution modernized to the current moment. It's very easy to do. Congress has the full power to impeach a president and a vice president at the same time.
And then who takes over?
Speaker of the House.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Well, yeah, Denny's in a little trouble right now. But here, let me try and say why. This is something that comes up a lot, and here's my argument on this. I know that a lot of people don't like Dick Cheney and Dennis Hastert, but if for impeachment to work, for it to be appropriate, it is not about the personalities. Impeachment is about saying, if as a president you commit these acts, you will be removed from office. It is as simple as that. And frankly, if somebody else assumes the office following you and commits the same acts, they too will be removed. It is more about putting constraints on the office than it is about the individuals. Remember, the founders were, again, ingenious about this. Impeachment is the only sort of high crime and misdemeanor situation where you can be charged and tried, where your only penalty, the only penalty, is that you leave office, right? And you give up the privileges of the office. You're not sent to jail. You're not dragged out in leg irons. You're not shot at dawn. You know, none of the things that happen in many other countries. Impeachment is not about policing the individual. It is about policing the office. The office, when it has too many powers, too many privileges, becomes a place of abuse. Impeachment addresses the abuse. And while I am fully in favor of impeaching both Bush and Cheney, I will tell you that the real thing that we should be in favor of is saying to future presidents, you can't operate like this. And
John
so I
Nichols?
Don't worry as much about who takes over as I do about sending that message.
I see. John Nichols, our guest today, we're talking about his brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. John, we have a full bank of extraordinarily patient callers. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Farina, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi, thanks so much for this another great show, Bob.
Oh, my pleasure.
And Mr. Nichols, thank you so much. Now, they're saying in that Congress voted to give Bush so-called war powers or authorization for military force. Mm-hmm. So my question, A, how is that different than declaring war? B, isn't this authorization actually subversive to the very Constitution they're sworn to protect? And C, shouldn't some of these congressmen also be impeached along with the president for not upholding the Constitution?
Okay, great questions, Ina. And I'll take them one at a time. There was no declaration of war. How is the so-called authorization different from a declaration of war? Simply in the language itself. A declaration of war is a formal declaration. It's called that. You introduce a declaration of war.
And the last one in this country was on December 8th, 1941?
Yeah. Historically, a declaration of war. You know, the concept of a declaration of war in this country was that we never anticipated that we would have a president who wanted to affirmatively go to war, who wanted to launch an aggressive war. So a declaration of war always was a very easily understood thing. If the country was attacked, you would declare war. Congress would be called into session, and it's a very simple concept. These so-called authorizations, both after September 11th in that traumatic week in 2001, and then in the fall of 2002, taken as first the initial authorization as a completely open-ended authorization to pursue the war on terror however and wherever the president wanted. And then secondly, in the fall of 2002, as an authorization supposedly to go to war in Iraq, were really not that in any sense. They were, in fact, they were abuses of the process. You took an emotional time in that year after September 11th, and the Bush White House looked to create the facade of congressional approval. But the fact is that we have had no declaration of war against Afghanistan. We have had no declaration of war against Iraq.
Hey, John, why is it, for example, in 1964, Lyndon Johnson didn't just say, let's declare war on North Vietnam and the National Liberation Front of South Vietnam, get a formal declaration of war? Why did he doctor up the events that created the Gulf of Tonkin resolution?
Well, we know from Bill Moyers, who was in the Johnson White House at the time, that they felt a declaration of war in that Cold War period with the Soviet Union might be pushing things too far. They were playing a game back then with the Soviet Union and to an extent with what was referred to as Red China, now our close trading ally.
Okay, now the war is over. The Cold War is over. Why don't we start declaring wars again?
Well, first off, that was an abuse then. It should never have been allowed back in 64. Thankfully, Wayne Morris and Ernest Greening vote against. But but today, again, it's good for the White House. It's good for the president. A declaration of war kind of stops things in its tracks. The American people have to take a serious look at it. And two things happen. One, authorizing a president to maybe go do something in the future is a lot more jarring to the less jarring to the American people than a clear declaration of war saying we are going to go to war.
Mm-hmm.
That's number one. Number two, there are legal issues here. If the United States declares war against another country that has not attacked the United States, mm-hmm. in an international sense, the United States puts itself in an aggressive position and one that could well be challenged in international bodies such as the UN, international courts. It's an appropriate challenge and one that the Bush administration, frankly, doesn't want to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the answer to the question. Ina's very good initial question. There has been no declaration of war. The second thing that she asked, that it's a subversive to the Constitution. Yes, absolutely. What's happening now is exactly the sort of abuse that Jefferson and Madison feared. Finally, she asked about impeaching members of Congress.
Yeah, who go along with this and don't raise hell like Henry Gonzalez has.
Yeah, there is no procedure for such things. Congress has the power to censure its own. It also has the power to remove members. So the members of Congress police themselves. It's not a very appropriate situation, as we've learned this week with the Mark Foley mess. But the concept of the founders was that the legislative branch was closer to the people, and thus members of the House in particular would face election every 2 years. And so they believed that the electoral process could police the legislative branches. What they feared was an all-powerful national executive, not nearly so close to the people, not nearly so regularly regulated as the every two-year election, and with the powers of the executive branch to ensure his continuity in office, they felt that the impeachment procedure ought to be directed at the executive branch, and that's where it's at. As regards impeaching members of Congress, on November 7th, you as citizens will have an opportunity to sit as a court, so to speak. And frankly, the way the complete abdication of its responsibilities by this Congress would argue, in my mind, for sweeping an awfully lot of them out of office.
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest today on Media Matters is John Nichols, Nation's Washington correspondent, frequent guest on the show, but usually on the programs when we're asking for your support. Don't worry, he will be back in a couple weeks to ask for your support. He's also the author of the brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism, just published by New Press, just came out with an introduction, or a foreword, excuse me, by Gore Vidal. Let's go back to the phone lines right now. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, hi. My handset might go out any second now because of the low battery, so a quick question.
Okay.
As I'm sure you're aware, Nancy Pelosi last week and Democratic members of Congress have consistently maintained that they will not impeach the president after the election, that they're going to move on and do other things. I'm wondering, isn't there something inevitably personal about impeachment? And wouldn't it be better for Congress to simply pass laws that repudiate certain practices that we might repudiate?
I think we lost the caller at that point, but I think you got the point. And let me add something to that, John, while you prepare your answer. We've had on this show a couple times, including just a couple weeks ago, a U.S. Representative Bernie Sanders from Vermont asked about impeachment, and Bernie Sanders has acknowledged that he thinks the Bush-Cheney administration has committed serious impeachable offenses. But like this caller paraphrased Nancy Pelosi, said it's just not worth putting a lot of energy into. We ought to just fight on other fronts because it's sort of a dead-end street. What's your take on that argument?
I couldn't disagree more. I think that there's a reason that the Constitution contains six separate references to impeachment. There's a reason that impeachment was detailed at such great length by the founders and a reason that they spoke about it so frequently. They recognize correctly that impeachment alone is the vehicle by which the Congress polices the executive branch. Congress can pass laws. That is true. The president has the power to veto those laws. Those vetoes can, in rare instances, be overridden. But it's interesting that the vote level to override is the same as to impeach for the Senate. The important thing to understand here is that the impeachment process says to not the sitting president, who, by the way, is, of course, if it's seen to its completion, is removed from office, but to future presidents, you know, here's the line, here are the rules, and you will be prosecuted, you will be punished, you will be held to account for this. If we don't do it, no matter what Congress does, no matter what laws are passed, what reports are put down, the slow creep of an imperial presidency will continue. We saw this writ large, and I deal with this a lot in the book, with the response to Iran-Contra. Let's be very blunt. The Iran-Contra affair of the mid to late 1980s saw clear violations of the law and the Constitution by members of the Reagan White House. President Reagan acknowledged this. He also acknowledged his awareness of at least some key aspects of it. And yet, in the Congress, there was a desire not to impeach, because Reagan was a doddering old man. Some people felt he was already losing some of his faculties, and many Democrats thought it would seem cruel or unfair or an unpleasant thing to do, or maybe even politically unattractive. And so they didn't. What they did was they had a big set of hearings, and they put down a very detailed report, and it was, you know, very firm in its language. It amounted to a firm slap on the wrist for the Reagan White House. Well, the fact of the matter is Dick Cheney, who served in the House at that time, saw that as a huge victory. He said, yeah, the president, you know, Congress passed a couple laws, the president got a slap on the wrist, but you know what? The forward advance of an all-powerful presidency can continue. And that's just, you know, if Nancy Pelosi thinks that we're going to get any kind of real change in this country, that we're really going to hold this president to account and change the direction of the country, or if anybody who supports her believes that, I would suggest to her that they are living in a fantasy world. That is simply not how politics works. And until we have a serious discussion about impeachment in this country, we are very unlikely to have the possibility of a different setting, different circumstance than we have today.
Now, John Nichols, in your book, you talk about U.S. Representative John Conyers Jr. from Michigan, who is the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee, where articles for impeachment would originate, and who, if the Democrats were to win the House of Representatives this November, would in all likelihood become the chair of the House Judiciary Committee, giving him a great deal of power to advance such articles. Talk a little bit about Conyers and what you think he would do in that position.
Well, of course, many Democrats have counseled John Conyers to be very quiet during the course of this campaign because they fear impeachment. They fear it's politically volatile, that it might inspire some Republicans to go to the polls who might not otherwise go, and make Democrats look vindictive, blah, blah,
and
blah.
And plus, as you pointed out, they know that the news media is extraordinarily unsympathetic as a rule.
Which really proves to you why we need a different media in this country, because they ought to love impeachment. It ought to be, you know, it's like the best theater going. But no, they're in the forefront of policing this, of saying, no, this is scary.
You're as sort of the wacko lunatic fringe to even suggest this.
They don't even report on it. You know, most Americans don't know that close to 40 members of the House have signed on to a Conyers resolution calling for an investigation of the potential need to impeach the president and vice president. So the one thing that people should know in answer to your question is that John Conyers has indicated that he is willing to explore the issue of impeachment. He has put down a resolution, it's House Resolution 635, which does in fact suggest that a special commission should be created to examine the wrongdoing, the lies, the deceits, the crimes of the Bush administration, and if it's determined that they reach a sufficient level, that commission should draw up articles of impeachment against the president and vice president. So Conyers has put himself in this place, and it's the right place to be. And there's a reason why Conyers is there. He's the only member of the Judiciary Committee, the current committee, who also sat on it back in the Watergate days. He remembers those days well. And he was part of an effort then to hold Nixon to account for the secret illegal bombing of Cambodia. Conyers understood that the most important aspect of impeachment was as regards the abuses of war powers. And he's never lost that consciousness. He's more experienced in this area than any other member of Congress. He has more knowledge. He has more background. And frankly, I will say that despite the fact that he's been rather quiet during the current campaign for political reasons, I think he has more courage than anyone else. I think if he is chair of the Judiciary Committee, he will do the right thing. And the right thing is to open up a discussion. Whether it leads to impeachment is another issue. But certainly, our Congress ought to be free enough and open enough to have a serious discussion about whether, if you lead the country into a war illegally and immorally, if you spy on the American people, if you conduct government in secret, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, you may in fact need to be held to account via a variety of actions, perhaps censure, but perhaps impeachment.
John Nichols, our guest today in Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left. John Nichols, the author of the brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment. We have two callers who have been patiently waiting, so I'm going to ask them to give their calls quickly. And John, I know you'll try to give a quick answer. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Thank you so much, Bob. I really enjoy your show, but I got into your show today a little late. The question I wanted to ask, was there ever any sort of movement towards impeachment when Lincoln was president? I understand that he pulled some very serious shenanigans, and I wanted to know if you had researched that. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
You know, John, I just want to say, having read the book, if people want, one of the most interesting chapters in the book deals with Lincoln, not when he's president, but rather as a member of the House during the Mexican War. So, John, proceed.
Yeah, very quickly. Now, there wasn't an effort to impeach Nixon during the Civil War.
Lincoln.
I apologize. Lincoln, because I think it was a unique circumstance. You actually had physical fighting on the turf of the United States, crossing back and forth over that Mason-Dixon line. And there was an acceptance at that point that things had gotten beyond, frankly, the impeachment stage. The South had decided effectively to, quote-unquote, impeach Lincoln by seceding from the Union. And so it didn't get to that level, although the caller is exactly right. There were great abuses committed during the Lincoln presidency, and sometimes those are cited as justifications for abuses in the current moment. But that's precisely the wrong direction. I mean, we ought to say that the appropriate thing would be to look back and realize what Lincoln did wrong and make sure it never happens again. And the interesting thing is Lincoln himself understood much of this. Back in the 1840s, he was part of a huge effort that was quite successful, actually, to censure hold to account former President James K. Polk for the illegal and immoral invasion of Mexican territory in what was called the Mexican-American War. So Lincoln's writings on this were wonderful, and I prefer to focus very closely on the wisdom of Abraham Lincoln as a congressman rather than some of the abuses he committed as president.
John Nichols, our guest today. We have time for one final caller. John, we have a Monticello here in Illinois. It is just as beautiful, I think, as the one in Virginia where Jefferson came from. Let's go to that line now. Line three, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Yeah, thank you. It just amazes me. You Bush haters have always had this thing about the president, but you failed to talk about Clinton and what his abuses were and how he got impeached. And you know, it's always Bush hate this, Bush hate that.
You'll be delighted to know there's a section on Clinton in the book.
Yeah, and what is your take? Did Clinton, was this an appropriate use of impeachment to follow up on the caller's question?
I'm delighted that he calls, because one of the most important things that I do in the book is argue respectfully that Bob Barr, who launched some of the first efforts to impeach Clinton, actually came from an appropriate place, and that unluckily the process was warped and abused and turned into a sex thing that was silly and, you know, the Monica Lewinsky stuff.
But what was the core issue, that Clinton had lied under oath?
No, well, that was what it actually developed into, was a silly little fight over sex and the Lewinsky stuff. But what Barr started talking about initially was the trading of campaign contributions for policy decisions in the Clinton White House. And intriguingly enough, the same people who argued for Barr to go forward with an impeachment effort against Clinton have been, some of the same lawyers have been arguing for a similar effort against Reagan or against Bush.
Mm-hmm.
One of the fascinating things is that some of the greatest legal minds currently arguing for impeachment of President Bush are conservative Republicans who were supporters of the impeachment of Clinton.
You know, John, on that note, I'm afraid I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they're going to clear me out of the studio and let Tavis Smiley get in here. John Nichols, our guest today on Media Matters, talking about his brand new book, The Genius of Impeachment, The Founder's Cure for Royalism. John will be back with us in 2 weeks during our pledge drive, along with Amy Goodman. And next week, we've got Jonathan Adelstein from the FCC. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my great producer, for helping with everything, as always. Brett Polson, our engineer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back in 167 hours. Take care.